All right. Can you hear me properly? Yep. Okay. Well, thank you. Hello, everyone. Last week, Roshi gave a talk, and she was sick. I'm sick myself, so yes, it started on Tuesday. And then yesterday evening we had the meditation group here in Paris. And I really didn't feel good at all. I was sitting on my cushion, sweating. my nose was running. And as often when the situation arises, probably some of you also have that experience, just like a koan pops up that is right on spot, appropriate for the situation. And the koan that kind of naturally came up is a koan that one of the few koans I kind of know by heart, or at least kind of the core line, is the one that maybe some of you know it, the moon-faced Buddha, sun-faced Buddha. I wasn't planning to talk on that. I had something else in mind that I've been immersed in for the past couple of days. And I want to tell you about a sutta that I read, which I thought would be interesting. But then something that came up, and I thought, well, let's just dig this one. And this is a koan that comes from the Blue Cliff Record collection, and it's the third case of the Blue Cliff Record collection. So some of you know it. And it's the character that is central to this koan is Matsu Dawi, who was the second generation of after Huineng, the sixth patriarch, and he was from the eighth century in China. And he was a character, and that really helps for the koan also. He was a character that kind of defined what we have in mind when we think of a Zen master, this very macho guy, very strong, that would scream at his students and be very male in his behavior. And it's important because he was like this very strong character, and that probably the koan takes place when he, towards the end of his life, probably even the last few days of his life, when he became really old and sick and weak. And so it's very short. So Matsu is reduced as Ma, Master Ma. And so the case goes as follows. Great Master Ma was unwell. The temple superintendent asked him, "Teacher, how has your venerable health been in recent days?" Well, basically, how are you? You haven't been really good. How are you? And the great master said, "Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha." So, as always, there are a couple of references that might help in order to understand what's going on in this koan. Sun-faced Buddha and moon-faced Buddha refers to names of Buddhas that appear in a particular sutra, which is very specific to Mahayana Buddhism, where there's a list of names of Buddha, and there's one called Sun-faced Buddha and another one called moon-faced Buddha. And the characteristic of the sun-faced Buddha is that it's a Buddha that lived for 1,800 years. And so it really kind of symbolizes eternity radiance, basically. Whereas the moon face Buddha is kind of the opposite. It's a Buddha that is said to live only for day and a night, and that even doesn't have a mouth, because he lived for only 24 hours, so he doesn't even need to eat, actually. So we really have two very, very distinct Buddhas. And as Buddhas, they are a manifestation of us being fully present. So, I mean, if we think about the situation that this really old and sick man, about to die, master, lying on his bed maybe, and someone walks in and says, "How are you?" He could have easily said, "Not well," or, "I'm pretty good today," or, "I really feel like shit." But he says something totally different, which, because it's a koan, it's really it points to something way more kind of meaningful. And also, probably it stayed because it really also points to what the Chinese used to, say, the great matter of life and death. And this is what we chant every single, the dedication that we hear every single morning when we sit. Let me respectfully remind you, life and death of supreme importance. As you know, in Zen, this is like really just something that we really try to deeply look into. This great matter of life and death. And this matter of life and death, which is here expressed also in the moon-faced Buddha, that really symbolizes impermanence and transience, and just like things are passing and things are dying. So from one perspective, he's impermanent. He's going to die. And he knows it, probably. Not probably, he knows it, as we all know that we're going to die. So what does it, if I go back to why it came up for me, was that sitting with me feeling unwell, it's like all these uncomfortable sensations, sensation of discomfort, sitting with that, sitting with sometimes, I wish I felt I would feel better. Not really. I kind of didn't really want to sit, but because people showed up, I just decided that I had to sit. So I was blowing my nose during the periods, the two periods. And really trying to experience the how the mind is actually racing, and just can I accept, can I just let go of all the clinging that I have? And this is really what the koan is pointing to. If he would have said, "I'm unwell," this was he would have this would have been the manifestation of him clinging to a particular type of perspective, but he was trying he's trying Matsu is trying to express something different. Embracing his experience in a non-dual way, as all koans try to point to, like a non-dual experience. Above the koan, there's a short text, and the Blue Cliff Record is really like a was really like a manual for the monks, actually. And so it's like it gives really clear instructions about how we should practice. And in this particular koan, it says one device, one object, one word, one phrase. The intent is that you will have a place to enter. So one device, one object. It's like we're really entering very precisely with one phrase, one word, like, yeah, a koan, like we think Moon Face Buddha, one phrase. The intent is that you will have a place to enter. Still, this is gouging a wound. This is like cutting a wound in healthy flesh. It can become a nest or a den. And so we're really kind of resting in there.
Can you repeat the last part?
The intent is that you will have a place to enter. Still, this is gouging a wound in healthy flesh. So we're really just opening up. We're really looking inside, really. This is what we're doing. And it can become a nest or a den.
Or a what?
A den?
Den, DEN.
Yeah.
Oh,
Une
okay.
tanière. Une tanière. Yeah. A nest. What is it? Un nid?
E.
Un nid? Un nid ou une tanière? Really interesting. Like this
Where
idea
the,
of.
for Krisha, nest is where the birds, baby birds are. And the tanière is where the fox go underground. It's like a hole underground.
Yeah. So it's a really beautiful image. Like we're entering, we're really with one word, we start really to create a nest for ourselves. Yeah, or a den. A dwelling place. I like that notion also of a dwelling, you know, a dwelling space. We're dwelling in something. But like this nest is also a nice image of the, yeah, we're resting in a nest. And the great function appears without abiding by fixed principle. The great function appears without abiding by fixed principles. So the point, the whole point, I probably you've heard also Roshi talk a lot about the functioning, you know, in the koans. It's like we're trying to manifest the koan, just like free functioning. I used to use, like this was like at a certain time in my practice, this idea of free functioning. We function freely. That's the whole purpose of our practice. We try to function freely, not abiding by fixed principles. The intent is that you will realize there is something transcendental. It covers the sky and covers the earth, yet it cannot be grasped. I have a lot of, I have to admit, I have a lot of problems with that. This whole idea that you will realize there is something transcendental. I don't know about you, but it just for me, it just this is not my experience in the sense of, and also I find it's very much, I know that it's very much something from our tradition, you know, this whole thing of, seeing things as they are. But I think what I've repeated that many times. To me, it is not about reaching a kind of a knowledge about the reality of things, but it's more like a practice of not being fixed, which is something different. I don't know if you know what I mean. It's like, this idea, I see things absolutely the way they are because my ego is totally out of the way. So suddenly I have a transcendental insight about the way things are, like ontology, right? And my understanding is, and it's not my, and also my experience is that the Buddha always tried to avoid this is or this is not. And it's exactly what it is said before. It's like not being stuck, not abide by fixed principles. So if we do all that, we abide by, we're not abiding by fixed principles. Our experience is not, it's not like suddenly we realize that, oh yeah, I totally know from a totally transcendental perspective what things are. It's a very, it's something that not all Buddhists would agree on, depending on the traditions. But certainly, I mean, if you look at the Pali text, it's very clear that, and I mean, it's just like not even going back to the Pali text. My experience is that it's really, I find it much richer to just remain on the level of what is my actual practice, and my actual practice is not being that, not being, not abide by fixed principles. And so it goes on, this way will do, will this way will do, not this way will do too. This is too diffuse. This way won't do, not this way won't do either. This is too cut off. Without treading these two paths, what would be right? Please test. I cite this for you to see, and then there's the case. So test this. This way will do, not this way will do. This way won't do, not this way won't do either. Right? We need to test that. We need to test and see how things go.
Can I interrupt you, John?
Yeah,
I
yeah.
don't understand. Test what? I'm lost with the doing, not doing, doing, not doing. My head gets crazy.
Well, we well, basically you test the options. What if you remain, what if you remain with just the moon-faced Buddha or the sun-faced Buddha? You just remain with a, oh yeah, this is all, I'm not experiencing just the fleeting discomfort. I'm beyond that. I sense I'm connected with a sun-faced Buddha that is this, the Buddha that lives more or less forever, right? That is on the level of eternity, and I'm also, okay, I can connect with that. And can I also connect with God, it hurts. God, I do not feel well. Right. It's not that the guy wasn't feeling the pain. Probably the guy was feeling the pain. Does that clarify that? Yeah. Well, let's just read it again then. This way will do, not this way will do too. This is too diffuse. This way won't do, not this way won't do either. This is too cut off. So it's really always like the 60 blows. You say a word, 60 blows. You say yes, 60 blows. You say no, 60 blows. You don't say anything, 60 blows. Where do you stand? What do you do? How do you respond? And maybe this is something kind of almost the next step. What do we do with all that? I was thinking suddenly I kind of today, as I was reading the koan, I was making a little exercise. I was thinking, how about if we enlarge this koan and nuts and thinking it's not great Master Ma that is unwell, but it's we enlarge that not to an individual but to the planet. And you're asking the planet, how are you doing? Sun face Buddha, moon face Buddha. What does it imply? What do we do? It actually links very much to what I originally intended to talk about, which I wanted to. I was thinking of talking about this. So this sutra on cultivation, which is in the Anguttara Nikaya, the numerical discourses of the Buddha. This huge text, this huge book, and that really tries to map. This is what I thought was interesting, to map what the practice is about. What does it cover when we say we practice? So I won't go into the details because it would take way too long. But the only thing that I will mention at that point is that it's a framework that really covers a lot of grounds of what is here, which is practicing our ability to welcome what is, experience non-duality. But also, how do we respond to the situation, and what do we do in our actual life? Stephen Batchelor talks about what is it, ecosystem or something like that. Yeah, ethical ecosystem, an ethical ecosystem. I really like that idea that it's on our. On the individual level, but it's also very much also about how we interact with one another, how we interact with the world, how do we say in English? How do we, comme on est au monde? How do you
Comment on est?
Comme être au monde, notre
Being in the
Mona
world?
l'idée d'être au monde,
Being in the world?
being in the world, being in the world, but in a very kind of ethical, ethical way. How do we respond? Yeah, and this koan really kind of was it? Yeah. In a very simple matter, Matsu just really faces his own vulnerability. This great matter of life and death. And that fixed, yeah. Not abiding, not without abiding by fixed principles. Yeah. Moving from eternity, and radiance to impermanence and transience, basically. And how does that apply in our life? How can we practice that? So this is why it came up for me yesterday as I was sweating and sneezing. Trying to do that, and so that came up. Yeah. As most koans, it's very radical. It really touches on something that is the aspect of life that is very fleeting, that is and yeah, what I was thinking of also is the dimension of self-care also in approaching our experience this way. There's something very gentle I find. As we can recognize and abide in this very kind of enlarged perspective. Yeah. And so in that sense, this the Matsu is expressing something that has to do with freedom and not so much about illness, actually. Yeah, and it's a he's meeting each moment. It's like, how can we meet each moment with full presence, not abiding, what's the expression? Not abiding by fixed principles, without abiding by fixed principles. Yeah, and as I said, I find it interesting to think about it in terms of just in terms of enlarging this, not to enlarging this to think of this koan about the planet, for example, about ecology, the environment. And how do we respond? I think that's all I have to say. I think I've, on my side, I've exhausted the exhausted for the moment this going. I can't remember if I had already kind of discussed that koan. And I certainly remember that the retreat we did in May when I got sick, and I was sitting in my inflatable bed thinking about that koan and trying to experience that also.
Yeah, I think you did talk about it then. I remember you talking about it.
Yeah. Yeah, I really like that koan, the simplicity of it, and also I like these koans where you can really just remember just one word or two words, you know, moon face Buddha, sun face Buddha, and that's it. You have the spirit of it. And in situations where you feel you can relate to that, and just like, pops up, and it can be very useful as a practice. As every week, I have the kind of the difficult task in the institutions where I work to do guided meditation, and I was asked to basically bring different topics each time, different topics, and so each meditation should be like on a certain topic, which I do find that extremely interesting, because it really also it helps me to realize that we can really guide our meditation. I mean, our meditation practice, like our formal meditation practice, can take many, many forms that really respond, or that we can really adjust depending on what we actually need to work on. And this is also why I thought the sutta that I mentioned on cultivation was interesting, because it mentions 32 facets or 32 aspects of what can be practiced. And in this sutra, in this discourse, there's this beautiful image that I also mentioned several times, where the text talks about a hen, une poule, that has their little eggs, and we imagine like if each egg is a quality that we're trying to develop, like compassion, equanimity, you know, all these things. And if you, as the hen needs to kind of cover all the eggs in order for the eggs to become baby chicks, we need to kind of keep covering and keep shifting around these eggs in order for all these qualities to mature. And at times, I mean, and we can just really decide that depending on the situation, that maybe we should focus on more on one than another. I find that extremely useful. And so when you're sick, you know, that is something that we can use. If we are particularly concerned with one situation, one question, one emotion, this is also an intention that we can bring. And the general framework can be framed into the four vows. This is another kind of the overall, you know, framing of our intentions. But at times we can really just like pick one particular aspect of it. If we have difficulty with compassion towards others, maybe, yeah, the first vow of how to say, well, sentient beings. Maybe this is something that we can work on more specifically during a period of formal practice. And that means also that we can be really creative and imaginative about the way we practice. Invent koans for ourselves, invent practices, invent ways to tackle these issues within that general kind of large ethical ecosystem, which again are really kind of framed. One framework could be the four vows. Maybe I should stop here. So if you want to share something or respond or ask questions or.
So I'm thank you so much, Joa, for this Dharma talk. And I wish I could be so clear in order to tell you so many things that came to me during this Dharma talk. Well, first, I think you are something for me. You are a kind of you make sculptures with words. That's what I feel, you know. You have this capacity of choosing the words in order they seem to me like chef-d'oeuvre. And this remind me my mother because I used to share with her a few things I learned or I took from our retreats. I used to share with her, and she would say to me, "Well, go on, my daughter, go on. I don't understand nothing what you're talking about, but I like so much to hear. So go on." And I would go on. And she'd say, "Well, thank you. I don't understand, but I love it." That's something that I also feel. It's not that I don't understand nothing at all, but most I don't. But I like to hear because it's beautiful. And it also reminds me an artist that is you must know, Joseph Beuys. He used to say that our conversations, the way we communicate, is a sculpture in itself. That's why each of us humans, we are all artists. That's what he used to repeat. So I took some notes, which I've been these last days, I've been trying to go through my notes, and most of them I don't understand what's there, but I will keep these notes. And anyway, I thank you very much, because it's a big challenge, and it's beautiful. So thank you.
Yeah, Debbie.
Well, what I want to share is much less poetic, but this reminds me, many years ago, a long time ago, I was with Frank in Belgium in the winter, and wherever, before he found where he has his retreats now, these were always really barny old monasteries, freezing cold. You could never get a warm shower, and we were all sick. And his thing was, and it's funny, it really stuck in my mind. He said, Belgians have a tendency to play with their nose. Leave it. Just let it drip. And I spent the whole day with snot all over my face because I had a real bad cold. And he said, as a matter of fact, I was so shocked the first time I saw Amy blow her nose in the Zendo. I had this sort of Frank reaction of, you don't blow your nose in the Zendo. Because of that day, but I to this day, I don't think you're allowed to use a Kleenex in Frank Zendo. And we sat there all day long, and it was so amazingly strong, the desire to obey by the rules, and also I really like Frank and I trust him, and the need to blow my nose. And all day long, as there was this amazing stress between the two. I remember I talked to my father on the phone the night after this happened, and he said, how are you? And I said, I don't know. I've spent the whole day with snot all over my face. I don't know, but it was so, you know, never in my life since I was a baby did I have crap coming out of my nose and not taking care of it. And I wasn't alone. No coughing, but you weren't allowed to use any Kleenex or anything. It was so amazing how strong the different tendencies were. So when you were talking about that, I was thinking of remembering that day.
Yeah. And yesterday, actually, I was what I'm really very much concerned with the snot is that it goes on my rakusu. That's about the only thing that I'm really concerned of. And I'm like, so each time if it's like this, it's okay. But when I feel it's about to drop on my rakusu, I'm like, I want to save my rakusu, because it's already like after 4 years, it's like kind of already super dark and you can't clean these things. So, but it's very interesting. Kind of the physical discomfort that arises in meditation, and what do we do with that? And the discomfort can be, just our knee that hurts or something, but that could also be, we want to blow our nose, and what do we do with it? Yeah. And it can also realize, I mean, we see how the mind is racing. You know, it can be, I should abide by the rules. It should be, I don't want to disturb people. Or it could be, this is going to be disgusting on my rakusu. And then we have all these thoughts that keeps coming up. And I always think that is so interesting. And to decide at some point, you know, yeah, am I going to do nothing or am I going to do something? And it's really... Well, up to the rules, up to, you know, who fixed the rules and what do we do and how do we play with that? And, what am I fixed on? I'm very much fixed on not trying as much as possible, as not trying to dirty my rakusu.
It reminds me of the first retreat I did. I didn't know anything about anything, but I went there with a sciatica, and it was really painful sitting, and after a few days, I had this really like At some point, it just shifted, and the pain was there, but it wasn't painful anymore. And it was like this, yeah, it was this revelation. Probably had a not revelation, but an awakening then of just being the pain. And I was just thinking of what you were saying about things as they are, and not, and this is it. I mean, it's not anything for me. That's my experience of this is it. I mean, things as they are is snot on your nose. That's it. And it is, yeah, and you're right. It's nothing supernatural or anything special. It's, yeah, and it's not fixed. It can't be fixed because it can't. It changes. And it's different for everyone. So, yeah, that's what I wanted to share.
Yeah, you had a moon-faced, sun-faced Buddha experience
Yeah, I
in this
guess.
retreat. Yeah, I mean, this is ex exactly it, you know. And the thing with the this is it, I think, yeah, I mean, if we understand, I think we really need to see it as an experience and not as a statement about the nature of things. And then we get caught up. And I think certain Buddhist traditions got caught up, and all Buddhist traditions almost got caught up ultimately in that. Whereas this is kind of, for me, the genius about Shakyamuni Buddha is trying as hard as much as possible not to get stuck in the this is, you know, this is eternity, this is, you know, there's a self, or there's no self. And really, each time people would come up to him and say, is there a self? Doesn't answer. Is there's no self? Doesn't answer. We get caught up. But if we see it as an experience, as a field of practice, then it becomes, as Stephen Batchelor says, it becomes a task. It's not a truth. It's a task. It's something to accomplish, and I feel that is for me, this is much more fruitful than something that would be fixed. And it's just like, oh yeah, I've attained some kind of insight about the nature of reality. You know, this is this there we are more into the realm of less of a realm of experience to the realm of kind of supposed knowledge, like.
I don't know if I'd say it's a task. I'm not sure I understand that, but.
Well, a task is, you know, in the context of, I mean, what Stephen Batchelor understands that is like when we talk about the Four Noble Truths, his point is to say it has never been, I mean, that would be so counterintuitive to think of the Buddha declaring some truth about reality, you know, the reality is suffering, the source of suffering is this and that. But it's more like, okay, can we, he's translating these truth, this so-called truth, in terms of things that we can actually do, things that can we actually practice, which is very different. You know, can I embrace suffering instead of saying, oh, the world is suffering, the life is suffering, reality is suffering, is like, can I embrace? My task is to embrace the suffering of the world, and this is very different. You were there, Lisa, when he came and he did this workshop, this talk on the four truths and the four noble truths, the four noble truths and the four tasks.
At the
I don't know if you,
center.
yeah, the center.
I do
This
not
is,
remember the talk.
you don't remember, yeah. This is something that we could study in the study group because it's the reshaping of these four noble truths. I find are very, very fruitful. You can find that short. It's like a couple of pages in the After Buddhism. Very, very, very interesting, very useful, very applicable also. Makes so much more sense in terms of our experience. Yeah, Krisha.
Good evening, everyone. The koan, it's quite, it was difficult to enter. Although I do love the sun face Buddha and moon face Buddha. Did I say it right? What strikes me, I love the sun and the moon. They are really both beautiful. What more resonated with me, or what was more easy for me, that I'm very tired to, it was when you start talking about that, and Lisa also. About that moment, things are as they are, and it's a bit complex on the English, this one. Things are as they are, and not being fixed about it. And by experience, and I really resonated with that in this sense, because it's, for me, it's totally clear. It's by the experience, you have to be open to the moment, to what is there. And it's impermanent, so if it's fixed, it won't it 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 works immediately, would catch you in a trap. And we were talking, or you were talking a bit about feeling sick and with the nose and wherever, which can be very annoyed, blah, 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 blah. But I think this also really points to when it's not a cold, when it's a disease that gives you a lot of pain, or whatever, and how to be open to this moment and let the for me, when I can experience that about day-to-day situations, I think it comes a joy. It's really a joy, a happiness, or a joyful place of embracing reality as it's manifesting in that moment when it's not comfortable. And I can open to it and be with it and be fully with it. And in this saying this, I can understand you, Joa Sensi, say about this is a task. And I understand how you felt a bit exhausted after, although also you are sick, but this, or as Anna was saying, this koan really goes to a lot of places. It's complex, it's difficult to understand it, and then to talk what is this resonating about me. But yeah, basically is this, and thank you all.
Yeah, you're absolutely right that it goes way beyond feeling sick or I was thinking also how, as you were speaking, I was thinking also about the way today in the world we are so much, we get so much fixed in position. I mean, just like politically, people get fixed and each have their start to have, we all start to have our own reality. And some people live in the bubble of a certain reality with alternative reality. And it also reminded me of an individual level. On Monday, I was in an institution and I did an introduction to meditation with a bunch of professional of the health in the healthcare institution. And after an hour, we went around, and there was one man who said, "You know, I didn't participate really. He didn't do the exercise. He didn't do the meditation." He said, "You know, with what's going on in Gaza, I can't allow myself to feel when I know that there's so much suffering out there." So even having the courage to just or feeling authorized just to look, to turn the light inward, as we say, you know, as Dogen says, to turn the light inward and not to feel guilty about that. And when he said that, I was really, just what came up for me right away was this Avalokiteshvara, the embodiment of compassion, that is said is the one who hears the cries of the world. So it's certainly not. And again, going back to Stephen Batchelor's idea of an ethical ecosystem, it's really has to do with hearing the cries of the world. So I kind of tried to go in that direction when he said that. So yeah, and that's maybe another implication or something that we could draw from this koan.
John, what did you say to him? I mean, specifically, how do you counter something? Because I mean, it's
Well,
legitimate. I can hear it.
yeah, I can. Yeah, well, I first of all, I acknowledged. I said, okay, but in a way, I said, you know what? By acknowledging that you it was too difficult for you, you actually did it. You know, to the level of what he could, but he recognized that there's so much suffering in him, it creates so much reactivity, that's as much as he can say. He could have walked out from the beginning. He didn't. He stayed there. So in a way, he had to do something while we were meditating, while I was doing a guided meditation. And then that was the first part. But the second part was also to recognize that they were all healthcare professionals. And in order for them to be able to respond appropriately in their work, whether it's in Gaza or right now in the office, was their ability to actually, you know, welcome, embrace the suffering that was around. And that includes their own. You cannot separate it. It's about listening. But that's how I answered. I don't know if that changed anything, or I don't know if that how it landed, but certainly, I mean, at least recognizing that this it was a legitimate question. I mean, it was a legitimate position. All right, we're running out of time. Lisa, you're making a signal for what? For the time? I can't hear you.
Je crois que Yvan a cherché à parler, mais son micro est coupé.
Oh. Attends, non. Oh. Yeah, oui.
Non, je disais simplement, est-ce que
toutes les positions ne sont-elles pas justifiées intérieurement? C'est-à-dire que j'écoute quelqu'un qui a été abusé, par exemple, ou que j'écoute l'abuseur, tous les deux ont une, comment dire, d'abord une souffrance et une vérité intérieure qui les amène à cela. C'est-à-dire que c'est finalement ce à quoi ça m'amène, c'est le non-jugement qui me paraît être la position, une position éthique essentielle et qui va dans le sens aussi de ce que nous faisons ici.
Oui. Et je rajouterais aussi pour la personne, c'est aussi de voir aussi où est-ce que ça accroche. Ça, c'est la première étape. On peut l'entendre en tant qu'écoutant, mais où est-ce qu'on accroche, quoi? Où est-ce qu'on est, on devient figé dans nos positions, ou que ça nous met dans une position tellement figée de, et que ça nous, ça nous, ça nous en, it forbids us to flourish, basically.
Pardon, il est, it's time.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you so much,
Merci.
everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sensei.